Good morning, all. We're ready this third day of class to consider the third sign or the third living parable of Jesus as they unfold in the Gospel of John. So we're ready for Jesus healing the lame man by the pool of Bethesda. And this unfolds in John 5. Now you'll notice that John 5, 1 opens with, "After this there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went to Jerusalem." We're starting to see some subtle little clues creep in here, more and more referenced by John in the writing of this book, and which we must conclude portrays the change in the thinking and perspective of Jesus as well. There was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now, John in this verse indicates a change then. And it's a perspective change of Jesus, I submit. It represents a change because of the prevailing strategy of the Jews that are now closing in on him. And that's the phrase, "a feast of the Jews." This dovetails into the prevailing use of the phrase you'll see throughout John, "the Jews." So watch for this usage and notice the context as it tends to suggest a change of perspective. Now back in John 2, 18, "Then answered the Jews and said unto him, What sign showest thou unto us, seeing that thou doest these things?" And you'll notice also in John 3, verse 25, "Then there arose a question between some of John's disciples and the Jews about purifying." So in this present account now, regarding this third sign of the invalid being healed, the people who rebuked the healed man for carrying his mat on the Sabbath were likewise called the Jews. So that phrase has now become a label for a strata of hateful, confrontational Jews who are bent on removing Jesus from the scene. That's what's going on. Next, notice the resulting change in context in John 5:1. "There was a feast of the Jews that drew Jesus to Jerusalem, and something had changed, and the Apostle John was trying to show this. The feasts were originally called Feasts of Yahweh, were they not? Why are the feasts now referenced as the Feast of the Jews? What had happened here? What had clicked over? They were Yahweh's feasts, were they not?" Let's look at these verses. Leviticus 23:2. "Speak unto the children of Israel and say unto them concerning the feasts of the Lord, which he shall proclaim to be holy convocations, even these are my feasts." Ezra 3:5. "And afterward offered the continual burnt offering, both of the new moons and of all the set feasts of the Lord that were consecrated, and of every one that willing offered a freewill offering unto the Lord." The feasts were historically the feasts of the Lord. But by the time Christ came to the Jewish people, the law of Moses had become so corrupted that the feasts were no longer the feasts of the Lord. Instead, they were now referenced as the Feast of the Jews. They had become then old wine. Now, this introduction then serves to set the stage for this third sign, which depicts much controversy over Jesus' healing on the Sabbath. And the Sabbath, in context with this, was really a lesser observance when contrasted to the implications of Jesus healing an invalid man, considering who he was, the Messiah, on the scene now. Now, breaking the Jewish tradition was a direct assault on their now corrupt institutions, and in John 5, verse 16, introduces the decision to seek to kill Jesus. And therefore, did the Jews persecute Jesus and sought to slay him because he had done these things on the Sabbath day? So, that represents a change in venue as things progressed on. Verse 1 to 4, then, in John 5 and 2. Now there was at Jerusalem by the sheep gate a pool which is called in the Hebrew tongue Bethesda, having five porches. In these lay a great multitude of impotent folk, of blind, of lame, paralyzed, waiting for the moving of the water. For an angel went down at a certain season into the pool and troubled the water. Whosoever then first, after the troubling of the water, stepped in, was made well of whatever disease he had. The five porches are laid out like leaves of a petal, and the water runs down and drains into subsequently lower pools. And it looks just like this in the overhead, of course, in much decay. Tradition says that the pools had unique healing qualities for the person who could get into the water first after it was troubled. Jesus had a specific purpose to go there. He didn't happen to go by and see this man. He went there with a specific purpose, and it was no coincidence that it was on the Sabbath day. Jesus is starting to engage in a frontal assault on the traditions of the Jews. Jesus next engages a man who had been lame for 38 years, yet was unable to ever access the water first to be healed. Now, it's incidental as to whether an angel is troubling the water periodically to affect this healing opportunity. It's incidental for this parable. It could just as well have been a plumbing scenario that pumps and moves water, whatever. In verse 6, Jesus asked the man, "Wilt thou be made whole?" That's a key phrase. Wilt thou be made whole? Jesus had read the man correctly to ask such an obvious question. Wouldn't you ask anybody, "Would you like to be healed?" And they'd say, "I certainly would," with much enthusiasm. "Of course, you bet I would." But there was not that response. Instead, the man launched into a defense. Jesus made him a little uncomfortable, of course, by implying, how could you have been 38 years at this and not been able to get into the water? Do you really want to be healed? So the man over 38 years had become obviously a fixture by poolside, and he was no doubt an accomplished beggar. Verse 8 tells the story and the why, ending when Jesus says, "Rise up your bed and walk." Rise, take up thy bed, and walk. Now this occurred on the Sabbath, and this was Jesus' target, not necessarily the healing of this specific man at this place. Otherwise, he could have walked to the edge of the pool, waved his hand, spoken a command, and healed a myriad of people who had been there for a long time. So, next, the anticipated drama would start to unfold. Jesus was making a frontal attack on the Jewish traditions because the focus of this chapter was to show the complete failure of those Jewish traditions. That's what we capture here in John chapter 5. The healing had its desired effect in verse 10 to 11, and it gained the attention of the Jews. The issue would have been over had Jesus not found the healed lame man again in verse 14 and pressed the point. Afterwards, Jesus findeth him in the temple and said unto him, Behold, thou art made well, sin no more, lest a worse thing come upon thee. Sin no more. So Jesus was not through with his lesson. He re-engaged because he had more to accomplish. Ordinarily, we want to find a healed lame man like this in the temple giving praise to God, do we not? Wouldn't that be the next logical conclusion? But Jesus knew this man's heart, and therefore his texts were terse and to the point. Behold, thou art made well. Sin no more, lest a worse thing come unto thee. So why reference sin? Well, we could say he was referencing the man's Adamic sin nature. But obviously there's more to that. Lest a worse thing come upon thee. The man by countenance was probably scamming the scene, and now he had a dilemma. He would have to work, and he wanted to not aggravate the Jewish hierarchy. He went right back in and, in essence, ratted out Jesus to the Jews. That's where his allegiance was. This was a blatant act of betrayal. You see that in verse 15. The Jews had upbraided him for carrying his mat. He pushed the blame off to the one who was healing him to deflect their anger from himself. Instead of standing up to him like the blind man who would stand up to the Jews in upcoming chapters. As stated earlier, miracles do not always generate faith or belief. The lame man manifested neither. Thus Jesus' sharp words to him were justified. Now, in Acts 3, verse 6 to 8, I'm not going to turn it up, but we have John and Peter healing another lame man. In contrast to this situation, that lame man entered with them into the temple, walking and leaping and praising God. There was none of that with this man who was healed. This was an attitude of pure thanks and joy to that healing. Yet John never recorded what the man in this situation ever said. Scripture never says that he praised God for any of this. There's nothing written about this man glorifying God in any way. This is why Jesus' last statement to him says nothing positive to him. This sign has more to it than meets the eyes, needless to say. The answer lies in the fact that Jesus was showing a parable that was to reinforce the lesson that unfolds in John 5 here, that being the unwillingness of the Jews to leave their traditions and live according to God's principles. More development is necessary to get our arms around this parable. You notice in John 5, 2 that there's reference made to a sheep gate. That the man spent his time at the sheep market or the sheep gate. And this was not identifying fluff that John was putting in here. John was trying to create a bridge or a tickler back to the Old Testament where God referred to his people as sheep. Now, reading from Jeremiah 50, verse 6. My people hath been lost sheep. Their shepherds have caused them to go astray. We wouldn't have picked up on this topically, would we? And the prophets, Israel is described as lost sheep. We've been considering that this week. Their leaders were directing them to all the wrong places for pasture. In Ezekiel 34, verse 2 to 4, woe to the shepherds of Israel that do feed themselves. Should not the shepherds feed the flocks? The diseased have you not strengthened, neither have you healed that which was sick. Neither have you bound up that which was broken, neither have you brought again that which was driven away. Neither have you sought that which was lost, but with force and with cruelty have you ruled over them. So, God's people had been oppressed by their shepherds, and they were still being oppressed and not fed by their shepherds. They did not heal the spiritually sick. Because of them, their people were invalids. That's a point being made. Israel was regarded as this invalid. The people were all figuratively languishing like diseased sheep around the pool of Bethesda. Bethesda means house of mercy, yet mercy does not fit well with the theme of this chapter. So we look and find that in the RSR, the King James Version, the NIV, the word is Bethzatha, with a Z, Bethzatha, and it means house of olives. Now this is more relevant then to the application of this being diseased Israel. The olive tree really connects this to the nation of Israel, and again John was hinting that this man, this entire scene, represents the Jewish people. John gave another connection, and that being the 38 years that the lame man had been languishing by the pool. There's only one other place scripturally where 38 years is mentioned, and that's regarding the sojourn of Israel in the wilderness after coming out of Egypt. You can reference that in Deuteronomy 2, verse 13 and 14. So when Jesus told the lame man to rise, take up thy bed and walk, it sounded much like Moses' command to now rise up. That languishing situation reminded Jesus of this lame man who was wasting away in his infirmity along with others around the pools of Bethesda for a similar length of time. So during his teaching, Jesus asked questions that often made people uncomfortable, did he not? That's an acceptable way of teaching when one is honing in on one's personal problem that hasn't been addressed and that needs correction. Make the person a little uncomfortable and hopefully we'll see change. And this healing, and Jesus did bring a measure of healing to this man. There's no doubt about that. But in the overall picture, to many of the Jews in general, there was not going to be healing in that generation. In John 6, verse 66, this is given to us by a clue, which I'll read. From that time, many of his disciples went back and walked no more with him. So there was a trickle of defectors, or there was, at the end, a flood of those who would forsake Jesus because they didn't like his message. It either made him uncomfortable, he didn't come as a king and a deliverer of the Romans. There was a trickle. Now, They turned back to the Jewish establishment, as did the healed man, and seeking for the approval of the hierarchy in the temple. The temple had a huge pull upon people, upon their worship there. To be put out of the temple was like an Amish person to be shunned and put out of the community. It was a life-rending event. But Jesus, in his concern for them, said, "Sin no more, lest a worse thing come upon you." Their swings in belief finally ended with their rejection of him, and thus the worst thing that he prophesied about was 70 AD. Now, in his writings, The Wars of the Jews, Book 5, Josephus says, "I shall therefore speak my mind here at once briefly, that neither did any other city ever suffer such miseries, nor did any age ever breed a generation more fruitful in wickedness than this was from the beginning of the world." This was the worst thing that Jesus had warned the lame man, the sword of Damocles, in 70 AD. Now, this was the focus, then, we said, of this chapter. The Jews were so engrossed in their traditions that, as Jesus had said, "Do you want to be healed?" They obviously did not. They would be starved, ravished, and burned in defending their temple rather than to avail themselves of Yah's salvation in the ministry and purpose and presence of Christ. Now, lastly, this alternate rendering of Bethsaida as the House of Olives takes our minds to Romans 11, does it not? The grafting chapter, the good and holy roots being the holy roots of Israel. The grafting chapter where we read, "I say then, hath God cast away his people? God forbid. How much more shall these which be the natural branches be grafted into their own olive tree, and so shall all Israel be saved. As it is written, there shall come out of Zion the deliverer, and shall turn away ungodliness from Jacob." So the time is coming when the Jewish remnant will cry to Yahweh for salvation, and they will find him, scars and all. So on the overhead, we have some takeaways. The signs continues to highlight the sickness of Israel, which only Jesus can heal if desired. End time humanity desperately needs a shepherd to heal their wanderings in the wilderness of democracy and humanism, yet it prefers to cling to their wicked shepherds. And that's the $64,000 question, and it has survived the centuries. Do you want to be healed? So moving on, we're ready for the fourth sign, the feeding of the 5,000. You'll find this now over in John 6, verse 1 to 14. The feeding of the 5,000, along with the raising of Lazarus, represents the high point of these eight signs, and it represents the high point of John's gospel. There are a lot of little details in this, and they come at us up front before the conclusion of the parable. In contrast, then, to the previous three signs, which are recorded only in John, the feeding of the 5,000 is recorded in all four Gospels. So we have to draw from the various Gospels to get the full story. We'll look at the story first, which is pretty straightforward, and then we'll pick up details. By this time, the killing of John Baptist had recently taken place, and Jesus was very saddened. It also served to remind him that his upcoming sacrifice and crucifixion was just 12 months away. This was Passover time again. And Jesus knew that next year he was the designated sacrifice. Jesus felt a need to be alone with his disciples to recharge his battery. So through prayer and solitude, this is the process to draw out of the mainstream and to pray and to discuss things over with his loyal little band. He wanted to know how their preaching effort had gone down, because you recall they had been sent out in this interim to preach to the populace, and he wanted feedback to know how it was going. Mark 6 is relevant to read here, and I'm going to read Mark 6, verse 30 to 31. And the apostles gathered themselves together unto Jesus and told him all things, both what they had done and what they had taught. And he said unto them, come aside into a desert place and rest a while, for there were many coming and going, and they had no leisure so much as to eat. So they needed a little space and a little quiet time together. On the overhead is a nice picture of the north end of the Sea of Galilee. I've been there, and it looks just like that. A lovely grassy pasture that runs right down to the bank where this feeding very well took place. Now, rather than walk as everyone did at that time, Jesus and his disciples took a boat, and they sailed northeasterly to, we're told, a grassy spot between Capernaum and Bethesda. But a great multitude followed them and arrived about the time they did. So they saw his miracles, which he did, the many diseased folks that were healed. And Mark 6:34 tells us that Jesus allowed this intrusion by the throngs of the people because he was moved with compassion toward them. Lest we get to thinking that Jesus had a shell around him. Jesus recognized the need of the people, which we'll consider more in a minute. Now in John 6:4 is the simple statement that, and the Passover, a feast of the Jews, was near. So you'll notice that John records this as a feast of the Jews rather than a feast of Yahweh. That's become the phrase now that you'll see appearing throughout John. Jewry had taken this feast over, and it no longer piqued them to recognize the Lamb of God who is now in their very midst. The place selected was a grassy pasture running down to the seacoast and rising to a high point. It was surrounded by rocky and desert-like ground, dramatizing the existence of those fed by Christ living in green pastures versus those who were living in the arid world. Mark 6:34 says, as sheep not having a shepherd, he began to teach them many things. So the dynamics of this situation begin to set the stage for the lesson that was about to be unfolding, the miracle of the feeding of the 5,000. The populace by now were streaming after Christ. They were streaming after him in a hurried and harried manner. The large number, the fading daylight, which is a clue, was going to create a dilemma of necessary comforts, beginning with food and obviously other things. The crowd was becoming hungry and restless. The fading daylight was a reminder of a mortal's years wherein we all live, eat, make life-wasting or life-sustaining decisions. That's the reference to fading daylight. Jesus had a plan and a solution, yet he entered into the discussion with Philip about the need to buy food. This is an interesting little interlude. Jesus didn't have to worry about could they go out and buy food in the countryside. He already knew what he was going to do. It seemed a logical solution, however, for the apostles to go out and buy food. The 200 denarii was not enough that they had. One denarius was one day's pay for a laborer equivalent to one penny. The price to feed 5,000 would be staggering. It would be astronomical. But the Jews knew that that great price would ultimately be paid. Jesus knew that that great price would ultimately be paid to feed the populace of the world who would eat his flesh and drink his blood in figure would be made available, and it would be inexhaustible. It would be the great price in contrast to trying to buy a little bit of food to feed this multitude. His feeding of humanity who would follow and believe would be exhaustible, inexhaustible. He was the bread of life that came down from heaven. So that's the central theme, that the bread metaphor was Jesus, the bread sent from heaven. Now, that bread metaphor is further elaborated upon in John 6, as is on the overhead, 53 and verse 54, which we just referenced. The eating of his flesh, the drinking of his blood, in figure. Catholicism takes this and corrupts it, of course, don't they? That the Eucharist service changes to flesh and blood when one takes of the cracker and the wine. Now, the type of bread Jesus was about to provide for the people taught that he could provide food without limits for the needs of the populace through his disciples. That's an important little phrase as well. Through his disciples. He elicited them to help with the distribution of this food. The clue being they were told to distribute to the people. Now there's more development on the front end of this parable as there is on the back end. It was to be a learning lab, in essence, for the disciples. And it's a learning lab for us, as we'll see. So, the little boy who showed up with 5 loaves and 2 fishes was probably sent off by the disciples to buy food for just them, for just the disciples. Hopeful of yet, of sharing a meal with Jesus in solitude somewhere. So from the various accounts, the disciples would rather that the crowd would dissipate into the various hamlets and buy food for themselves. Jesus knew their hearts, the disciples' hearts, and he also knew and could appreciate their frustrations. So we all become agitated when our plans are interrupted or thwarted, don't we? We've got everything planned out in our minds and something happens and it's a little frustrating. The exhorting brother calls in sick. The sister preparing the meal is told she has 5 more coming for lunch. These little ripples is probably what the apostles were reflecting upon. In the Lord's service, we must keep foremost in our minds, whom do we serve? So that's something you can ask and remind yourself of. Whatever you're doing in the ecclesia, if there's a ripple, a decision, or a problem, it's whom do we serve? By injecting the child here, Jesus opens up a principle that would lead to further lessons reiterated throughout the Gospels and Jesus' teaching. So I want to go to Matthew 18 for just a second, and we'll see how Jesus looks on children. And that's why we view little children always as a special heritage, and not just little children, but young adults as they mature. We have great expectations for them. Matthew 18, 2-5. And Jesus called a little child unto him and set him in the midst of them and said, Verily I say unto you, except you be converted and become as little children, you shall not enter into the kingdom of heaven. Whosoever therefore shall humble himself as this little child, the same is greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And whosoever shall receive one such little child in my name receiveth me. So the principle's there. This word converteth, as we know, means to change direction and to focus. So Jesus is saying that as little children, my disciples, change your direction and focus on what's coming down here, on what needs to be done. Now, quoting from John 13, 33-35, again, and Jesus wanted to teach love to his apostles in and through service to others. And this is agape love used here. John 13, 33-35. Little children, yet a little while I am with you. You shall seek me, and as I said unto the Jews, where I go, you cannot come. So now I say to you, a new commandment I give unto you, that you love one another as I have loved you, that you also love one another. But this shall all men know, that you are my disciples, if you have love one to another. So the usage of the word love is agape. Now, the disciples were to learn that to be true disciples, they had to become singularly focused as a child, and believing as a child, free of baggage and hang-ups, and to be quick to serve the sheep who desperately needed a shepherd at this time. Now in the record, Jesus quickly got the disciples involved. That was his plan. He was teaching them agape love. They were to organize the populace into sit-down rows for a full feeding. This wasn't intended to be a snack. This was a full feeding, and they were to distribute the food to this host of people. The lesson was, you are to be my conduit to the people. You will work hands-on with feeding my sheep. And that involves their ecclesial development and maintenance, their doctrinal integrity, their physical ailings, and their concerns. And you'll do this whenever called upon to serve and at your personal inconvenience, because in 1 year I will not be with you anymore. The service involved is agape love in action. And this is what the interchange was between Peter and Jesus at the end of John, which we'll consider with the last sign. Lovest thou me? Feedeth my sheep? Feed my lambs, feed my sheep. The disciples would learn this. Now, by these days' standards, the people had a feast. They ate until they were full. The food didn't run out. They were full as they sat there and ate. Much as we think we know God's Word, there will always be more to feed upon. That was a lesson. The populace, like legion, was being fed at the feet of Jesus. And this needs to be our humble posture as well. Being so close to Passover, this feeding would reflect upon that feast, and later the connection would be made that Jesus was the Passover lamb in which they were figuratively feeding upon. The feeding took place between the two evenings, we're told. When the Passover lamb would have been slain, but now was no lamb yet provided. The people did not make that connection. Instead, they saw Jesus as the one to deliver them from the Roman occupation, heal their wounded, provide their food, and set up his own kingdom in their midst at that time. By making them sit down in groups of 50 as a company, they in essence resembled Roman legions in how they would move and sit together. The message was then that the people would have deduced, get ready for the outbreak of the kingdom. Something big is coming down. Some versions scripturally render this as an herb garden. So that thought might usher in the order of ecclesias in which the apostles in love would be establishing in their apostolic work. So in this posture, the populace was literally at Jesus' feet. As the mortal nations will have to prostrate themselves to take hold of the skirt of a Jew. But instead of the 5,000, they were all fantasizing on a rebellion or an upheaval that they felt was imminent, that this would be against the Romans, and that this miracle worker was to be their captain. So you can imagine the whispering and the excitement and the electricity of this crowd, which would be running through it as they were fed to being totally full, not running out of food. So perceiving this in John 6, verse 14 to 15, then those men, when they had seen the miracle that Jesus did, said, "This is of a truth that prophet that should come into the world." When Jesus therefore perceived that they would come and take him by force to make him a king, he departed again into a mountain himself alone. Jesus departed from there into a mountain, seeking to break up this discussion, this whispering, this movement that he was sensing at that time. He would feel the necessity to do that. He had been tested, after all, in the wilderness, had he not been, by a similar scenario where he could seize power? He had been there before in his mind, and he knew that this was imminent in this crowd's musings. They had it all: sustenance, power, kingship. Here he came. Now, judging from Matthew 14, 22 and 23, apparently the apostles were caught up in this as well. In Jesus speaking there, it says, Jesus, in the King James, constrained his disciples to get into a boat. The word constrained is rendered compelled. Jesus compelled his disciples, "We're leaving this place. Follow me. We're going to get in this little boat. We'll find solitude." Jesus had to redirect his disciples and to essentially extract them from this explosive scene. Later, this same misconception resulted in the disciples' discussion of who would be the greatest in the kingdom. So, but before departing, the 12 were instructed to pick up what food was left over. Now, they had 12 baskets full of food that was left over. I'm going to close here. I have three more pages on this parable, so let's pick it up next time.